Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about the influence of small banks in enabling more and more and bigger fintechs. India moves towards controlling its internet, when to buy and, importantly, to sell your stocks, and politeness in person-to-person payments. Please hit subscribe to hear this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get going. With me this week is Monica.
Hey, John. We're Steve-less today.
Steve will be out, but back with us next week for a very interesting interview episode, actually. All right, so let's talk about how fintechs can grow so quickly without even having a banking license. Now, we've mentioned this before, and even though there's a lot of services and all kinds of things, you think, hey, these guys, do they have insurance? Are they in compliance? What do the regulators think about this? That's because there are small banks behind the scenes taking care of these regulatory and operational issues. So you might wonder why a company like Chime or Square Cash can rise to so much success without actually having that crucial banking license.
You know, in the past, we've discussed how a lot of fintech firms partner with a relatively small and often nobody's really heard of it, regional or community bank to leverage the fact that they have a banking license and a relationship with the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I like the way they mentioned that they're looking for banks that are small and clean. Clean meaning they didn't have any of that mortgage-backed security issues. Or things that might cause the fintech problems later on, or unwanted regulatory scrutiny.
And what I think is interesting in this CNBC article is that they actually talked to a number of different banks that have gone this route and talked about how they maybe had a change of ownership and then rebranded as a way to make themselves more enticing a partner for fintech, because they already have the license, but what smaller banks don't always have is a way to get their hands on lots of deposits. So if you can create a relationship with a growing fintech firm, you might be able to kind of hold the deposits for them, and that helps your bottom line as well as the fintechs.
Yeah, I'm sure these small banks don't mind getting, even if it's a small cut, of a large number.
And they talk really, really smartly, I think, about how the regulated nature of banking in America creates a lot of complexity, both for your compliance and your operations and just kind of being able to legally do it. So having a bank partner that's already done it is useful. That said, these banks may not be able to ride this particular gravy train for too much longer, because one of the things that this article talks about is the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, is actually accepting applications for a national fintech charter, which would give the agency more direct oversight instead of regulating their partner banks. So you can see why the OCC wants to do it. But of course, if that happens, then the OCC, by offering a charter directly to the fintech, would probably kind of push some of these partner banks out of their current niche.
Yeah. So as you're growing up, for sure, there's a way to do that. There's banking as a service, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen some banks that specialize just in doing this. They offer APIs where you can connect to, between the fintech and the regulated bank. And that's kind of taken the priority off of some of these fintechs in really building up toward their bank license. One of the executives at Chime, one of the co-founders of Chime, said becoming a bank right now hasn't been a top priority for us. And that's a company that's taking deposits as checking, savings, and loans. And not really interested in becoming a bank right away.
Yeah. Another thing that I found interesting in here is this article does, towards the end, kind of tee up some stats around what's been happening in this space. So in 2017, fintechs originated over a third of the unsecured personal loan balances in the U.S. That is up from 1% in 2010. So in 7 years, it went from 1% to 36.2%. That is a huge huge intrusion in the unsecured personal loan balance space. And, you know, the fact of the matter is you haven't had a significant downturn in that period. We know these products are particularly appealing to people who tend to have lower net wealth, lower credit ratings. So it will be interesting to see how an eventual downturn will play out.
Yeah, and the big banks seem to be reacting like much like the innovative disruptions, like the incumbents typically do. Like, well, they don't offer this, they're not good enough at that, we keep the higher end type of services. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly, if you read The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen, I don't get any cut from that, is exactly how he describes incumbents, where the new guys come in, they're not as good, but they're good enough. And they start peeling away at the main business and eventually sucking the profits in away. So that going from 1% to 36% in the unsecured personal loans, it sounds a lot to me like that kind of a disruptor.
Yeah, and banks, pattern. Kind of big banks, have gone from 34% of that 9 years ago to 26.4% in 2017. So they've already seen that dip in that part of the business.
Yeah.
And it's been going to fintechs.
And they'll rationalize, saying, well, we didn't want that kind of business anyway. That's not the important part. But people get more and more comfortable with working with these new companies. You know, the next thing will be mortgage. The next thing will be their main credit card. And it creeps in that way. So big banks, if you're listening, be on the lookout. They're gunning for you. Don't worry about it. All right. So from the small banks of America to the Great Wall of India, what's going on in India, Monica?
Well, so the New York Times has an article up. They put it up over this weekend around the Indian government is proposing some rules that would allow the government to demand removal of content that the government deems libelous, invasive of privacy, hateful, or deceptive.
Well, that's most of the internet, so... I mean, bye-bye Reddit.
I was thinking the same thing, but I didn't want to pile in on Reddit. So this is something that these are a set of rules that have yet to be implemented. They are currently in the public comment period, but the Indian government could impose these rules at any time after Thursday, which is when the public commenting period ends. These are awfully similar to some of the rules that China has enacted for their local internet. And as part of these rules, it could be that internet companies would also be forced to build automated screening tools that would block Indians from seeing, quote, unlawful information or content, end quote. And these rules would also potentially provide provision to weaken the privacy protections of messaging services like WhatsApp so that authorities could actually trace the original message back to the sender. And if you know much about how WhatsApp was originally designed, that's not technologically possible right now. So, but at the same time, it's complicated because there are some fairly, you know, the Indian government has some good reasons for wanting to find kind of the original disseminators of false hate messages on WhatsApp, because these fly around India and the next thing you know, dozens of people are dead. So it's not that there's like no reason that the government would want to do this, but of course, governments might have complicated reasons for wanting to put something like this in. Of course,
to build national champions too. Like
absolutely.
The DESI app?
Absolutely. You can favor your national champions. And you can also use it as a way perhaps to bolster your own reelection prospects, which is exactly what some people are charging.
Oh, that didn't occur to me at all.
Prime Minister Modi of doing. The elections are later this year.
Yeah, Prime Minister Modi. Yeah. So a little bit of a problem if you're operating in India, the world might be shifting from under your feet, from what's been a traditionally very open tech scene to one where you might get pushed out. It might get tougher for you.
Absolutely. And in fact, it turns out that over 50 countries have already passed laws that kind of splinter the internet in some way. They provide for some variation of local control. But India is, like China, a huge and growing market, not just with the number of people they have, but also their potential for internet use. And some of the tech giants particularly Facebook and I believe Microsoft, are really kind of pushing back in India to create some kind of safe harbors that tech companies have traditionally had in a lot of these matters. They've said that the rules are technically impractical. They're, you know, a big departure from the way the rest of the world regulates this beautiful term called a data intermediary, which is a designation for companies that host the data that's provided by their customers and their users. So these companies don't, I mean, you've heard this line before, they don't want to be considered the publisher, they don't want to be considered the owner of this data. They just want to be the platform, baby. But don't regulate them like a utility either.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it does take a lot of effort to regulate the internet. I mean, China has, I think they said, some 1.5 million people working on monitoring everything, even
Doesn't
with their software.
Doesn't that just sound like job creation?
Yeah, right, right. Well, it makes me wonder if India has the will. And, you know, that's a huge budget thing, too. It's still a democracy. So it's tough to get that out there. I mean, even, you know, when you talk about all the camera surveillance in China, I think, I forget what the percentage was. A good percentage of those are fake cameras just to make people
really?
Think they're watching.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, they're not all powerful. I mean, they're building to make them all real, but they want you to know that they can watch you. And,
right.
And I guess they'll get replaced over time. But, I mean, this is to build your surveillance state for you dictators out there. I mean, it takes a lot of money, a lot of manpower. Even, you know, China, which puts so much effort into it, is still, you know, it's manually, people have to review. So hopefully this will be some top level type of things where hopefully they're focused on real criminals, you know, illegal type of pornography, mm-hmm. that type of thing, or real police or terrorist threats. Because beyond that, you're going to have to scale up hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, just Facebook alone has said they're hiring some tens of thousands of people to police that one company. Well, they have to pay that money out. They have to.
But they don't have to give them a free lunch.
Maybe maybe those people are already in India, and then they'll switch to the government instead of Facebook to monitoring.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a big effort. So I'm a little. You know, this kind of thing moving towards a surveillance state is always concerning. But, you know, I would take it with a grain of salt for now, you know, if they really put a big effort into it.
Well, when I look at how some of the biggest tech companies must be feeling in the world right now, they are welcomed with less open arms than most of them have ever experienced before. And what I do see in the proposed rules for India is it is a lot more around kind of controlling the content of what is posted, published, and distributed inside the country, comparing that to, say, like the EU's GDPR, which is a lot more, at least my understanding of it, is a lot more around providing individual privacy protections and control for individuals. And I have a stronger preference for one versus the other. But it does change the equation for a lot of these tech companies if they have to. One of the things that's allowed them to scale so well is that they can kind of do the same thing in every country. And whenever you look at a technology company or a company that thinks of itself as a technology company that can't do that, and you see that a lot in the fintech space and the transportation space, where they have to kind of comply with local laws, that makes their frictionless growth a little slower.
Well, I, for one, welcome our new internet overlords.
That's good, because they're growing.
Yeah. So, I buy stock. When should I sell it, Monica? Tell me.
Such a good question. So, Bloomberg has a not very long article at all about, really, would you be better off selling stocks at random? Like, could a monkey sell your stocks and you end up with better results than if you agonized over the decision for years and years? And some of it is really just kind of around the psychology of stock purchasing versus stock selling. So people tend to put a lot, and people, by which I mean individuals, as well as professional investors and money managers.
Yeah, we're all human.
Right.
Sure. Cognitive errors.
Yes, we put so much effort and analysis and thoughtfulness and protocols around what will we buy? And then when it comes time to selling, we don't always have the same kind of structure or format to help us make that decision. And the article kind of lists some of the ways that people have done it. You know, by feel is a classic one. After a specific period of time, you just automatically reduce some of your exposure to any particular stock, But they actually did highlight a research study that looked at more than 4 million trades amongst over 780 portfolios covering the time period from 2000 to 2016.
I like science.
That's a big data set, right? And found that stock pickers did show skill when buying. However, when institutional investors sold the stock, they kind of cost themselves as much as 100 basis points, which is a full percentage point, of yearly returns compared with a no-skill strategy of simply selling holdings at random. So if the professionals are leaving a percentage point on the table, what do you think you're leaving?
Bring on the monkeys.
Bring on the monkeys, exactly. So one of the things is that, you know, it can be the case, too, that when we've gone to all this trouble to do the research, oh, God, we picked this great fund. We love that fund so much. We have a slightly irrational attachment to that fund. So some investment companies actually take the selling decisions out of the hands of the people who decided to buy it.
Oh, I like that.
Which I think is a really good way to...
an objective, separate party. Yeah.
Yeah, as objective as you can get with human nature, right? Which there is a limit. But it is a good way to kind of reduce some of the innate psychological attachment that we all have in
our life. I would put it out there on Twitter and see what they decide.
that could also probably be as good as the monkeys.
The crowdfunding, yeah.
They note a company called Cabot Investment Technology, and they don't go into detail about what they do, but Cabot will
proprietary.
They will come in and they will analyze your investments and your portfolio and kind of help you see where you might be. So Cabot has scrutinized about $3 trillion in investments, and they got a black box, so I don't know what they're doing here, but they found that 1/3 of portfolios show the endowment effect, which is that tendency to hold onto a winning stock for a little too long after it stops outperforming. So Cabot is getting their business from professional money managers, and who knows who else is playing in this space, but I think this is, you know, when to sell is a question that just does not get nearly as much rigor around it as what to buy.
You know, I just got rid of all my cognitive biases on the buy side, and now I have to do it again for the sell side too?
Exactly. Oh, but I think that this could be a really interesting space for all of the insights that big data and AI can bring to us.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's the same kind of biases that they found before. I think there were some... one of the biases was about holding on to or minimizing losses.
Yes.
Losses are more painful than...
Loss aversion is real.
Loss aversion, right, is than what the gain you get. If you gain a dollar, that's a certain level of satisfaction, but losing a dollar is like three times more painful.
Yeah.
So all those studies, those Kahneman and Tversky kind of studies, which I love. They're so funny the way they designed these tests for those kinds of things.
They deserve their Nobel Prizes.
But right. I approve. But yeah, it's the same type of things you have to ask yourself and control for.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So you know what else makes sense is collecting on your debt. So Monica, I think, still owes me $3 for a coffee last week.
Etiquette fail.
That led me to this article on the confusing world of Venmo etiquette in the Wall Street Journal. No relation to that money you owe me, Monica. So we have a youngster. He says he's approaching his mid-20s in the article, you know, from experience, going into Venmo etiquette. You know, it's something that is kind of a new thing, right, in terms of the technology aspect. I mean, before you just lay out some cash, you're good to go. But what if you both use different types of, now that you're doing everything digital, what if you're both using different apps? Do you look just like a cheapskate because you don't have the Square Cash app and someone else has PayPal or something else? You know, these are
or
things
worse,
that come up.
Do you look digitally out of touch?
Oh, my gosh. I just got a card, for goodness sake. You don't have to have an app, too. Well, I guess probably people are getting apps more well before they get a card, right? So there's a lot of these little social cues that are coming up. You know, as the world changes, we always have new kinds of rules. And this is one of them. Some of the things are like, you know, when's the amount too small or too large to bother with? And how should you make a payment if there's a fee?
And how promptly should you request payment,
That's the big one. Like I was kind of tiptoeing around that.
Yeah, like if John and I go out to dinner and I pay because, you know, his wallet.
I always forget my wallet.
And do I sit there as the bill comes up and divide it by two and then be like, you owe me $42.71? Or should I say $42? Or should I say $43? Or should I say $40?
God, that Monica always goes to the penny, like it matters. Yeah, I mean, these things come up with this sort of thing. So yeah, definitely if you let something linger for a while in a generation that gets upset if you don't IM back in 10 minutes, I mean, what does that mean for somebody that sends you they're part of the payment and you don't get it back in an hour, 2 hours, 3 weeks?
There was one element here that I kind of wish the columnist had brought up, because I also think that kind of that mid-20s is when your friend group can often really start to diverge in terms of income and spending capability. And that is something that's not super well discussed, but it actually can be a strain on friendships and group dynamics. And I think it's kind of interesting how that also might play out in Venmo. Like, well, yeah, I can pay you back for drinks, but I need to wait until payday, right? Like, when you're saying that to your friend who has embarked upon a highly remunerative career in investment banking, that might make you feel bad, you know?
Yeah, so that's a good point.
I think that's something that groups kind of have to work their way through once you're kind of out of the even playing field of college.
Constantly. It's not like you can say, like in the old days, pre-internet, I just haven't seen you in 2 weeks, you know?
Because the old days are what John and I know well.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe even, I guess, pre-2000, 97 or something. Well, you still had to go to a computer, so that was kind of not, you don't expect a response right away.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there was no way to pay until, pretty recently. You would just get emails every day saying, hey, remember that $42 you owe me?
Yeah.
But you're not going to do anything about it.
I mean, we also lived in when we were this guy's age, we were in a world where you paid back with cash, you know? Yeah. And that's not the way it goes now. So it just, it changes things quite a bit. And
you buy, I fly.
Yeah. I think.
And it's worse if you can see, oh, hey, on Facebook or Instagram, yes. Hey, you were at a bar last night and you still owe me that $20.
I see you out spending my money.
Yeah. What's that thing, fancy drink you're holding up in that picture?
And I think money generally is something that's quite emotional. It has a lot of kind of
baggage,
hidden emotion in our society. And it's not something that most people are usually super comfortable talking about with others. And I wouldn't expect people who are, you know, kind of just a few years into their kind of adult financial lives to be any better at it than I am in my early 40s. So
there's
a lot going on there. And also, I'd like to give credit to the Wall Street Journal for always having a take on what the young kids are doing. I actually find out a surprising amount of things of what's trendy and cool from the Wall Street Journal.
Oh my God.
Which isn't trendy and cool, but they want their affluent readers to feel like they are. So I think they put in some effort on this. So now we know about Venicut.
Yeah. Monica's just joined, there's a new Instagram offshoot called Seniorgram. So if you want to reach her, it's fintechnewscast@seniorgram.com. And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it, plus our opinions.
Yeah, so I'm going to go first, and my final bite is 2.24%.
The amount of my raise last year.
It could very well be that, but
it's not even that high, don't worry.
It is also the APR that Wealthfront is offering on their new Cash app. So this would be a FDIC-insured account through Wealthfront that will pay you a pretty nice interest rate, which, you know, it's good to see some interest rates going up. One of the things that I found really interesting, though, as I was digging into their FAQs, that ties back to our earlier conversation around how small banks are kind of propping up some of the infrastructure in the fintech world, is Wealthfront is trumpeting the fact that you can have up to $1 million of your savings in a Cash account with them insured by the FDIC.
And but where will I put the rest of it?
I know. It's a hard decision. And that can be up to $2 million of FDIC-covered deposits for a married couple. And how they can do this, because if you aren't already aware, the FDIC insures $250,000 per bank account or per bank relationship typically. Wealthfront actually takes the dollars that you deposit with them and spreads it across four different program banks. And that way, all the dollars in each one of those separate kind of shadow accounts. Shadow might not be quite the right word, but I think you understand where I'm going here. Sub-accounts, that's better, gets the benefit of the FDIC insurance. So if you have $1 million or two, if you're married, laying around and you want to make sure you get a nice interest rate.
And some liquid accounts.
You can look at Wealthfront's Cash account.
Oh, I was going to make some cryptocurrency crack, but it didn't quite come in time.
They get enough hits.
All right. Well, who else has been hit are P2P lenders in China. My final bite is $1.5 billion, which is equivalent to about 10 billion Chinese yuan. And that's the amount that's been frozen by China belonging to P2P lenders. We've mentioned a little bit about the crackdown on P2P lenders in China before. And now it's getting, they're cracking down more and more. So this operation, they codenamed it Fox Hunt.
Ooh.
I like it, right?
Very British.
Yeah, yeah. They're, it spans 16 countries, including Thailand and Cambodia. And they're trying to track down a lot of these sketchy P2P players when this was a little bit less regulated. People have been disappearing in China with funds from these companies for a little while now. And if you're listening, then congratulations on getting out. But a lot of people are getting caught and getting hauled back to their to China on these charges of illicit financing and fraud. So, you know, it's probably a good thing overall. It's part of their limiting and centralizing and better controlling their financial system in any case. So it might not be tied to overall lending since the money gets stolen. So it doesn't really help the economy that way, right?
That's not really a loan, is it?
That's not really a loan, yeah. Well, they're getting the investors into the company. And that's how, if you're wondering, that's the scam, is they'll give you a great return if you invest in these P2P companies, but that might end up in a mansion in Thailand. So they expect that peer-to-peer lenders will drop again this year by 70%.
Woo!
Down to their target. And amazingly, when China says something will land at around a certain number, it tends to do that.
Isn't that funny? I'm sure there's no massaging involved.
Yeah, massaging and strict state control. And only 300 will be allowed, but we'll let the market decide. I'm sorry. So it'll drop to around 300 with a target of around 50 firms, which will eventually be the Chinese government will filter lending to the economy.
I wonder if those 50 firms will have good relationships with the Communist Party.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to see more back and forth than we see with Washington representatives and PACs. So this might not reflect overall lending patterns in China or the amount, but it does reflect how it will happen. All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, or have any suggestions for topics, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes, and thanks for listening.
We'll be back next week.